Hey, deserving listeners, we have a special guest on the podcast who knows a lot of things about a lot of things. So I thought we would get into that. Please introduce yourself to Podcast Land.
Thanks, Kirk. It's a real honor to be here today because I feel in some way I'm sitting here because of you. I reached out to you. I don't know if you remember this now, but I reached out to you and I think it was 2015 to talk about my potentially coming to Antioch University and to do a Fulbright scholarship with you guys. And here I am 6 years later. Pandemic later, sitting in Antioch, and I do owe a lot to you. And I think you put me in the right track, so thank you. And I've been listening to your podcast for many months now. In the last, it kept me going through lockdown in Ireland. So thanks, Kurt. And it's a big honor to be here today. So my name is Richard Hogan, and I'm a systemically trained family psychotherapist. I'm working in Ireland, and I'm the clinical director of Therapy Institute. And I write every week for a national newspaper in Ireland called the Irish Examiner. And I write about things that I experience in my clinic through my teaching. I teach in a school and I also lecture around the self and psychology and education. And so I write every week about what I'm seeing. I write about things that are, fascinating to me. I write about systemic racism. And my last article there was about the football in England and the racism that was leveled at the three.
Yeah, tell us about that. I remember reading a little bit about that.
Yeah, the players, it's a fascinating, for me, I found it really fascinating to watch because the players took a knee before the match. Each player took a knee before the match to outline the injustices and the inequities that live in society, right? A little gesture to say to society, we're not there yet. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. And England got to the final and three young black players missed penalties. And there was there's a guy called Marcus Rashford. I don't know if you know him here, but he plays for Manchester United. He's 23. This guy has done more in his life than most of us will do at this young age, than most of us will do in our lives. He's during the pandemic, he did an awful lot for the area that he lives in, humanitarily speaking. He went around and provided food. And, he does a lot for his society and for the people that he grew up with. And there was incredible racism launched at them. Okay. And so you could look at that and the government came out, Boris Johnson came out and said, this is terrible. This is awful that this is apparent. And of course that it is apparent, but at the start of the Euros, when they were taking the knee, the Home Secretary said, that's just gesture politics and we don't get involved in gesture politics. So diminished what they were doing. And then when she was interviewed about it and they said, what do you think of the supporters who were booing the taking of a knee? She said, well, that's up to them to do. That's their decision. That's their right to boo it if they want to, right? And Boris Johnson himself, the Prime Minister, was kind of equally muted about the whole thing when he was being interviewed about it. He kept quiet about what was going on. And then, of course, when there was a huge backlash to what these players had experienced, one of them was like 19 years of age and the racism on social media was just incredible. They, of course, spoke out because they realized that society, that the zeitgeist had moved slightly and that people were quite really outraged at what was happening. And then they were appalled and they were clamorous and they're appalled, they're appalled by what was happening. But as I wrote about it, I said, well, there's a systemic piece there. There's the systemic racism there. If the leaders are going to kind of joke about it and mock it and diminish it, you set the culture for what's going to happen in those stadiums. People in those stadiums aren't in a vacuum. They're from our society. And if your leaders mock what's going on when someone's drawing, when someone's shining a bright light on a very, very, insidious situation and that's there for all of us in all of our countries, and you mock that, well, then you allow the culture to exist. You allow these people. And my point was that the people who launched those racist remarks, while apparent, aren't the real issue. The real issue is systemic racism. What's in our society that allows them to feel that they can launch those racist remarks and get away with it? And I think that that's the kind of thing that we need to look at as a people.
Yeah, obviously in the United States, we suffer from similar kinds of systemic racism and leadership problems. What were the specific complaints that they were trying to raise awareness around?
I think what they were trying to say is that, people in England, they were speaking about England in particular, don't have an equal shot. There isn't equity of employment. There's not equity of opportunities. I think that's what they were really trying to say. And they were trying to say, I grew up in Ireland and I'm a real fan of football. And, during the years you'd see bananas been thrown at black players.
Right.
You'd hear monkey chants in the stadiums.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been a hard sport to follow. Yeah. For someone who has, really incongruent ideas to that. And I think what they were saying is that, they get criticized because they're making so much money. And people would say, a lot of people would say, well, you know, you're thriving under the system. You're thriving. You're making millions of euro, Marcus Rashford and these other guys. So how can you say it's racist because you're making so much money? But they're not talking about themselves. They're talking about everybody who exists in the society. And it's very easy to kind of go, you know, and look at that and say, but you're doing well. And that's what critics would say. And that's the systemic piece, I think. It's like, you know, Muhammad Ali throwing his, you know, his medal into the Ohio River and someone saying, well, he could have gone to a different restaurant. There was another restaurant that would serve him. So why do you want to go into the restaurant that wouldn't serve him? Well, that's the reason why Jim Crow existed for so long. And that's what they were standing up about. You know, they were standing up, they're standing up for, okay, we're doing well. But if you look at the arc of, you know, everybody's life, most people aren't doing well and most people aren't getting an equal shot. And that's what I actually really attached myself to this football team. Being from Ireland, that's a tough thing, I'll tell you that much, Kirk. I don't know if you know the history there, but, you know, to support the English football team would be something that you would never have even dreamed of as a kid. But when I saw what they were doing, and I was thinking, you know, this is what we need in our society. You know, we need these people to stand up and actually, like Rosa Parks, sit down and take a knee and say, look, things aren't equal. Things aren't fair here. And yes, we're doing well, but not across the board here. And that's what they were looking at.
Right. Yeah, I find it interesting that when they get attacked, they're making their point. You know, all they did is take a knee.
And the point that gets made, and I actually only heard this today, you know, that it's unpatriotic. You know, it's against the flag and it's against the country. And you're kind of going, well, they believe in the country so much. This is what, you know, they believe in the flag so much. It's not that they're against the flag or they're against the country. They believe in it so much. They want to see a change in it so that it's equal for all. And surely we all want it to be equal for all, you know, that we all get an equal shot at things.
Yeah. It's particularly egregious in the United States when racists will use that argument because our country is at least philosophically founded on equality.
Well, I think it's a very good point. And my grandmother was American. I love America. America in Ireland is like a concept. I think it's like, you know, we really look, it's like a big brother, you know, you're the big powerful brother that we love. You know, it's funny, you know, we have this relationship with America that we love the presidents and we always try to make sure that they're Irish. Somehow we wrangled Obama into our Irish kinship. And he came to Ireland in 2011. It was a very funny moment. He's one of the great orators, I think, of the, you know, the last 100 years. He's just a great speaker. Yeah. And he started off his speech and he said, you know, my name is Barack Obama and I'm here to get the apostrophe we lost along the way. And that dude had the audience out of his hand, you know, because we're like, yes, we know you're Irish. But he was the first black Irish president. that's what we say in Ireland. But I agree with you. But I suppose what I feel when I look at it is that it doesn't have to be one or the other. I think what I find happening in America when I look at it is the polarization, the, you know, the things that are really feeding into these echo chambers. And you can be both, you know, and that the difference between somebody, you know, who's a Republican and someone who's a Democrat doesn't mean that they're different in people. It's just a difference of opinion. And surely we can sit with the both and position. You can be patriotic and you can be a Democrat and you can be patriotic and you can be a Republican. And those two things should exist, you know.
100%. But to say that someone can't kneel to stand up for inequality is, to me, against the American ideal. You were involved with a television show involving people coming together with opposite points of view. Tell us about that.
Yeah, thanks, Kirk. We developed a show called Eating with the Enemy, you know, and I saw it over the last 5 years. I was watching, I'm always watching American politics. I'm always, you know, really interested in what's going on in America. It's just kind of my background. My grandmother's American. We always talked about America. We always went to American holidays. You know, it's just been a part of kind of the family and our tradition. And
in Ireland, you go to American holidays?
Yeah, we go to America for holidays, yeah.
Oh, you'd go to the United States for holidays. Oh,
yeah,
I see.
Go to holiday. Yeah,
I was just trying to imagine in my head. I'm like, you were celebrating 4th of July in Ireland or something.
And we would, as a family, we would talk about, say, Thanksgiving, definitely.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That'd be something we talk about in November. Yeah, for sure. That's cool. I'd have friends of mine who are American, you know, and we'd always connect and WhatsApp and talk, you know. And so there's always been that connection, you know, as a family. And I suppose when I thought about Fulbright, it made sense to me to go to America, you know, because it just felt right. Yeah. But the show, I was watching, say, Trump over the last 4 years, and while it was very entertaining, let's say, viewing for people who don't have skin in the game, let's say, you know, for a neutral country, it was entertaining and it was kind of seen like that. And, you know, people kind of viewed Jimmy Kimmel's take on it. And that was kind of like, you know, how we consumed it. It was like probably with confusion, a little bit of car crash. You didn't want to look at it, a bit of embarrassment. But I also, what I was watching was the incredible polarization, as I saw it, of people and the inability to have a discussion around difference. And like you said there, you know, Kirk, about when you say that it's unpatriotic, you're just shutting down the conversation. It's a very nice way to end all discussion, right? And that's how I'd see it. It's a very irresponsible and linear way to look at something and say, well, that's just that, and that's the end of that. Not, you know, let's not ask a bigger question, is why are they doing that? Mm-hmm. And what am I doing that allows that to be there so that they have to take a knee? And so, you know, that it's a much wider thing. It's a much more complicated thing to do. So it's much easier to shut it down. And I was noticing in schools, even in Ireland, because we are influenced by America, heavily influenced by America. I mean, we are as a country. And I was noticing in schools, students doing the same thing, shutting each other down. And if they had an opposing point of view, they shut them down and said, well, you must be a racist, or if you support Trump, this is what I heard here in the classroom. If you support Trump, because I try to get dialogue going, they'd say, if you support Trump, you're a racist. Right. And I was like, that's not that simple. Let's hear his point of view. Like, you know, let's have a discussion. And I was seeing this in the classroom. And then I was seeing it in universities as well, that they wouldn't be able to hear difference. They'd shut it down. And in my analysis of it, I was thinking, it seems like identity is getting kind of caught here. People's identity and what they believe are kind of coming together. And so we came up with this idea of the show called Eating with the Enemy, sitting people down from opposite sides of a discourse and hearing over a meal, because I over a meal, it's kind of an intimate thing to do, break bread with somebody, sit down and have a meal. And then we'd have questions that myself and the other psychologist, Malia Coyne, we'd prompt them through different questions to get them into some of the discourse that we want them to have. And it was just an incredibly successful show, first of all. But personally, you know, when they asked me to be involved in it, I was thinking this could be like Jerry Springer and I would want nothing, you know, you're this and you're that. And I was thinking that's nothing that I want to be involved in. I'm a very positive person and I want to develop discourse, but in a healthy way. And it was just incredible. We had a member of the trans community sit down with a Catholic priest. And we just had this really tender moment where the priest said, you know, because, you know, I don't know if it's like what it's like here, but, you know, the Catholic Church has had a pretty good grip of Ireland for many years, you know, and that's gone in the last 20 years. But the Catholic priest said, I try to look for God every day. And I found it in your conversation, he said to the member of the trans. Yeah, it was just an incredible moment. It was like a seminal moment in Ireland's kind of like history, where a Catholic priest was saying to a member of the trans community, you know, we're all one here. And you're beautiful, and God is in you as well. And, you know, the amount of emails I received from that moment. And we had people sitting down who were Trump supporters, and we had a you know, a member of our Black community who's a lawyer sitting down with a member from the, you know, supporter of Trump, and you have the discourse there. And what it really showed is that, yes, this discourse has become coarsened over the years, but actually there's no difference between us. You know, we might.
So how did they see eye to eye, the Trump supporter and the
well, they didn't. They actually didn't see eye to eye. They actually said that how they came to the conclusion is like, you know, we may differ, but I respect your opinion. And I actually, in that conversation, it was very interesting. The guy who was the Trump supporter, Luke, said, I've never had a girlfriend and he left his guard down. And in that moment, they actually connected through a very, very vulnerable and honest and transparent moment where he said, I've never had a relationship. And maybe that's why my views are, you know, lacking a little bit of, you know, broadness and something else in them. And the Black lawyer said, yeah, well, thank you for being so honest. God, I'm kind of taken back by your honesty there. And they actually had a really nice connection. And they didn't agree. They didn't come to an agreement, which, you know, doesn't happen always when you're having a discussion with someone. You don't have to. But they were respectful in their difference. And that's what we were trying to get to in the show, is that you can be different and have differing opinions, but it's about the dignity and the way you respond to somebody who's different. That's what makes, you know, a healthy society.
Right. And the increasing of the distance and the fanning of the flames is what causes some politicians to be elected and to line their pockets with a lot of money, frankly. It's basically a business to fan the flames.
Absolutely, Kurt. And I can see what really, really big, social media, like Ben Shapiro and all these guys that you have over here, and they speak about the coarsening of public debate, and yet themselves are the ones, you know, whenever I see the tweets come up, I'm like, well, there's a further coarsening of the public debate. There's a further, echo chamber. There's a further, it's either us or them.
Right.
And you write books about it and you make millions of euro off it, saying that isn't this terrible? And then you go look at the tweets and say, well, you're just, as you said yourself, so elegantly, you're fanning the flames here because it's very profitable.
Yeah. And the small minority of voices such as yourself that are trying to create understanding and bridge the gap and help people to think a little bit more, I think, accurately about their fellow human beings. There's no money in that. There's no money in like, hey, can't we all just get along? Or, hey, you know, those people you hate, they're probably not so bad. You're not going to make any money in that.
No, it's not. It's certain when you say to people, hey, how about the potential of holding a different idea?
Yeah.
That's not going to get you money.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's not all about money. It really isn't. It's actually about a society that's functioning and healthy that allows for us all to thrive in it. That's actually the stuff that gives your life meaning, I think. You can have loads of money and you can have absolutely no meaning. I do a lot of work in the corporate space, and I meet a lot of people who talk about that to me. They get remunerated massively and they wonder where the meaning in their life is. And you can do both things. You can obviously get remunerated very well and have meaning. And I think that's a really important thing, that just because you don't make money out of something, I think it's really important that you see, well, you know what? There's something that sustains me a lot more than being able to buy whatever it is. And that's doing work that's meaningful. And perhaps if you change one person's idea about something, or you allow them to see something differently, well, there you go. I think that's the payoff.
Yeah. So before we started recording, you were rattling off a bunch of other things that you are involved in. And what else would you like to share with the listener?
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm the director of Therapy Institute, and why I'm here in the Fulbright in America is because I'm really interested in inclusion, obviously. I really, you know, it's something that I'm passionate about, Kirk. I'm really passionate. And when I hear your podcast and I often hear that idea when I'm thinking, what is it that they're dealing with today in this? It's about inclusion and about holding ideas about people and holding them lightly. And I suppose labeling and how we talk to ourselves is something I'd love to talk to your listeners about, because I think there's a very important conversation about freeing yourself from the labels that you were given yourself through education. Mm-hmm. And I lecture in DCU in Dublin around this. I've written a course around this and I lecture on it. And that's what my Fulbright is really about. It's about training teachers how to think about inclusion. And inclusion is kind of a sexy word. You know, it's kind of a popular word at the moment. It's like hybrid. Hybrid and inclusion are the two big ones at the moment. And I often think it's just a word that people use and it's got no meaning. You know, let's just do inclusion. Okay. Let's do inclusion. What the hell does that mean, right?
Yeah.
And my idea about it is always that it starts within. I mean, if you hold really destructive paradigms about people, or very linear ideas about a certain type of person, it's going to be present in your classroom. It's going to be present in your life. And it's going to be present in your relationships. And so something I think is really important conversation for your listeners is to think about the labels that they received themselves. And I often find this myself when I'm talking to teachers. I can see the weight being lifted off them. I can see them kind of going, holy crap, I have been laboring with this label and it's not fit for purpose anymore. And I myself, you know, as a kid growing up, my dad was a journalist, a pretty famous journalist in Ireland. You know, he wrote for the Irish Times and everything looked great on the outside. You know, everyone said that family is fabulous, but he was an alcoholic. And so we were living with addiction and it was a pretty unpleasant place to be at times. And I certainly was labeled as a kid going through school as, you know, being bright and capable, lazy, not like his brother, you know, all that kind of stuff, difficult, problematic, you know, those kind of things were definitely thrown at me as a kid, you know, and doesn't care. Those were things that, you know, it doesn't, you know, going to waste his ability. And those are different things I heard as a kid coming through the school, and really labored with them for a long time and lived them out for a long time until I figured it out myself. And I think we all get labeled very, very heavily through the educational system.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it's direct labels like you're dumb or you're lazy, yeah, or
stupid,
something, or you're just treated that way.
Yeah.
Treated like you're incompetent, treated like you don't matter. Then those concepts definitely become internalized. Yeah.
They absolutely do. They become entrenched, and then they become, not only are they, you know, firing, these neurons are firing together, they're making this thought, they're becoming pathways. So when you have a thought about yourself, it's this negative thought: I'm not that good, I'm not valuable, I don't deserve anything, you know. And then they go off and launch into negative relationships to confirm what they already believe about themselves and further have dysfunctionality in their lives. And I think that's such an important conversation to have, so that you free people from the paradigms that they hold about themselves. Because generally, and this is what I found in my research, and I've carried out a lot of research around the self and inclusion and labels, you know, and when I say this to students, teachers, and to parents and to teenagers, someone who launches out a label and calls you stupid, or a teacher who says something negatively about you, or even, I think it's even more insidious than what you described, they just ignore you. And there's an unwritten thing there. You don't bother me, I don't bother you. You go through this, I'll teach these guys, you shut up over here. And I mean, it's an incredibly destructive thing for a child to experience, that isolation. Then that's what it is. It's exclusion. And that stuff really hurts, physically hurts. Like neuroscience would show us that when you're excluded, the part of the brain, the dorsal portion of the anterior cingulate cortex, fires. And that's the same thing that fires when you hit your hand with a hammer. And it comes from your evolutionary past. It comes out of, like, you know, when we were starting off on this human journey, and we were, you know, in our tribes. If you were outside that tribe, you were certain to die. So your brain developed a warning system to kind of go, whoop, you know, get back in your tribe here and don't be excluded. And when you do that to a child, you're actually, you know, you're firing that part of the brain, and it feels sick, sickness, you know, really, really terrible. Just this churning develops within the child's thinking about themselves. And as you said there, you know, the internalized voice becomes negative. And so what I try to do is I try to, when I say to teachers, you know, write down the labels you've received, positive and negative. And generally the negative one is, you know, and the positive one isn't so full. You know, the odd little thing here, but like really, like, you know, stupid, not that good, you're not as bad, you're not that bad. You never amount to, one person said to me, you never amount to anything. You're just like, you know, you're not capable, you know, you're stupid. And so what I try to show to people is that when you launch a label about someone, and think about it yourself when you're working and you're meeting people on your podcast, and your brain is going to be firing it and thinking, you're probably thinking when you met me, you know, Irish guy, and there's a few things going on in your head that you'd categorize, right? And that's because our brains are generally, you know, kind of beyond comprehension, but also a bit lazy. Mm-hmm. And we have about 60,000 thoughts a day. And are we conscious of those? No, we're conscious of the familiar ones. It just feeds up the familiar ones to us. And we're kind of going, yes, I know that kind of person, Kirk. So someone like, I know in psychology. And so your brain is kind of going, yes, in my out bias. And so we're saying these things. And so when a teacher says something really negative about us, it's speaking to their inability to have competency to manage you or to motivate you or to instruct you in a positive way. It's a way of relinquishing responsibility for the fact that you don't have the competencies to deal with the child. Mm-hmm. So when a teacher says that child, and I hear this all the time in the classroom or in the staff room, that child, Kirk, oh man, he's so lazy. You know, he's such a pain in there. You know, you hear those conversations, and I know exactly what's going on. Another teacher comes in and goes, yeah, he is really lazy. And then another person comes in, and it's a real powerful force here. Three mm-hmm. people sitting down going, that child is some pain in the arse, whatever they're saying about the child. And now you can imagine what they do when they go back into the classroom and that child is sitting in front of them, because their ideas have been affirmed by their other colleagues. That child is going to get absolutely excluded from the educational process. And it's really important that when you're a child who's experienced labels, because that's what we all experience. And when you're like the eldest, the middle, and the youngest child, let's say if there's three in the family, you know, your parents are labeling you, mm-hmm. the responsible one, the quiet one, the crazy one. You know, you're getting labeled by your family. And when your parents speak about you to their friends and you hear them saying, oh, you know, Richard, he's just an anxious child, you know, and you're getting labeled like that. Again, it's about inability. It's about competencies. It's about the inability to be able to manage or to you know, productively develop something in a child, positively help a child. And so when you label, what you're doing is you're removing the locus of it within you as the parent or the teacher or the educator, and you're putting it inside the child and you're saying, well, that's them. That's what they have. It's not my responsibility. It's them. They're lazy. They're good for nothing. They're stupid. So it's not me. It's them. Right. And it's incredibly destructive.
Yeah. Yeah, well put. When we feel powerless, you know, teachers are tasked with getting the kids through school, helping them to learn, getting them to pass. And when a child isn't doing very well in school, you might try a few things as a teacher. If those things don't work, then there's a temptation just to blame the student. And I notice this, and I see it for sure among therapists as well. When therapists get together, they'll label certain clients. But the difference with teachers is that multiple teachers will have contact with the same student. You don't usually have that with therapists. You know, therapists are usually consulting about a client that none of the other therapists know about. But anyway, I worked for a while, as contracted for many years with a school, and I would integrate as a professional with the other teachers and the students. And I would come to the student population fresh. I didn't know anyone. I didn't know the labels. I just came to the students with an open mind and would experience them as they were, so to speak, because I didn't have any preconceived notion. But I noticed that the teachers would treat the students differently. And it's just anecdotal. I can't really know for sure. But I found that there was always one kid that was thought of as the screw up or the rebellious one or the stupid one or something. And I would see them react to that student. And I just thought, why are you reacting to that student differently than the others? Because that student isn't really doing anything different. Or the student would just be a little bit more extroverted or a little bit more, or sometimes it was, I would take a guess and say that some of the more jockish students would be labeled stupid or something. I don't know if that was a bias, just like, he's sort of a dumb jock, even though I thought, well, he's not dumb. he's a little jockey, but you know, it's fine. Yeah. And it affected the rest of the students. I noticed that. So I'll never forget. There was this one moment where I'm hanging out with students. None of the teachers are around and everything's just kind of fluid and moving around socially. And people are talking and I'm talking with them. The teachers come in and as the students start to interact, I noticed they started labeling this one student. And then I saw the rest of the students kind of react to that student differently. And then I saw the student kind of shut down. And again, it's just anecdotal. I could just be making up a story, but I felt like in this little moment, I saw the kids being free to be themselves and that one kid able to be themselves without feeling like there's something wrong with them. The teachers come in with whatever story they had developed. Maybe the kid was, a difficult in the past or had trouble in some class. And then they just label the kid or, you know, treat the kid a certain way. And then not only do they get that, but then all the students fall in line with that narrative of that student. And then the student shuts down because of that narrative. It was interesting to watch for sure.
Oh, that's an incredible anecdote. That's an incredible insight into what I'm kind of talking about in my study. I mean, that's absolutely it. You know, and a lot of my work is through narrative. You know, I do a lot of work, you know, when I work with teenagers, I work with through a narrative lens, you know, about the stories that we tell ourselves. And there's a child who's been given an incredibly powerful story and that the class then align with the teacher when they come in and then he's further scapegoated. And, you know, it's so destructive. And you can imagine where that child goes off. And you'd love to talk to that child now and see, how long did it take you to figure that out? Did you figure it out? That it's about your teacher's competency and the students just went along with it. But there's a very famous study called The Pygmalion in the Classroom. I don't know if you're aware of it, by a psychologist, Bob Rosenthal, in the 60s. I think it was 64, carried out the study. He went into a school that was very highly streamed. You know, one was like, you know, academic and going to go. And down here in 5 or 6 were like, not going to attain anything. They were considered like the dunces and they weren't going to go nowhere. And Bob Rosenthal and his team came into the school and said, they're carrying out this test for Harvard. So it sounded pretty good, Harvard, right? So all the teachers were like, whoa, Harvard are here, fab. And they were carrying out this test called the inflected acquisitions test, right? And so they went through all the schools, all the classrooms, testing all the students. And then they gave back the feedback to the management and the teachers, and they said, you know, you're class five here. They tested the highest for inflected acquisition. They're going to go they're your superstars. And the teachers are like, what the hell are you talking about? These guys are the dunces. And they're like, no, this test, which is like, you know, Harvard. And they were like, okay, Harvard, it has to be, you know, reliable. These students are going to, they're going to really do well. They've got great potential. And when the real study was, they wanted to, what Bob Rosenthal and his team were doing, let's see how the teachers talk to the students now that they've got a different idea about who the students are. And they noticed when they set up the whole system and the real study, the teachers were much more hopeful in their conversations with the students. And as a result, their grades exponentially went up as a result. And that's exactly that's what brought up for me there as you were telling that story. There's a kid who's been given a narrative, who's been given a narrative that's going to always stop him from thriving, that he's going to live out and live that story out. You know, and that's why I wanted to have that conversation. It's really important that we free ourselves from the paradigm, these restrictive paradigms, because Kurt, as you know, anything is possible. We can do anything once we start to believe in ourselves, mm-hmm. You know,
and what other people believe in us, is what you're saying, right? We can't believe in ourselves unless other people believe in us. That's my belief.
Yeah.
And true. And I noticed this in my work with kids early on. I noticed that when I said, you know, we'd be talking with the parents and the kids, and the kid would be like skipping school or getting too angry at home or something, losing his temper. And I started to say to the kids, I know that you can do this. I know you can control your anger. I know that you can divert your anger in a different way, because I know you, because you're a good person and you're smart and you're capable and you're mature, even though in the back of my mind, there's another narrative, a competing narrative, that the kid is a screw up, that the kid will never amount to anything, the kid has an emotional problem. Mm. And it's easy to have that kind of narrative, particularly if that's the narrative of the family. And as I would just continue to, I would have to believe it to say it, it's hard for me to lie. But also I felt like if I truly believed it, it would come across differently too. And so I really focus, and almost like a mindfulness exercise, focus on the positive of this kid and really emphasize that and say, I believe in you. And again, it's just anecdotal, but I found that the kids would rise to the occasion. They would say, I just imagine that's what's going on in your head, is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That, I'm not a screw up. I'm not a problematic person. I'm not a person with an anger problem. I'm what this guy says, which is I'm a mature. Actually, where I got it from is my mom. My mom, I watched. So my mom had a daycare in our house growing up. And so I watched her masterfully manipulate help the children, because, you know, there's 10 four-year-olds running around her house and she had to keep them under control by herself. And since we lived in a pretty small house, I couldn't really get away from it. I wanted to at the age of 14, but I couldn't. But so I passively observed the way my mom dealt with people. And one of the things that she would do is this. She'd be like, a kid would fall and they weren't really hurt, but they would start screaming. Ah! And my mom would detect, they're just, you know, playing it up. And my mom would come up and say, you are a big girl and I know you can take it. And the kid would go, you know, and you just see the kid sort of stand up. I'm a big girl. I can take it. And the kid would go on. I'd be like, whoa, that's masterful. Like,
it's very true.
And I think that's what influenced me in working with kids.
And what that is like externalizing the problem and reframing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they're the two techniques that I often use with teenagers, is externalizing, because you do have ideas about yourself that they're concrete. The self is concrete. So, I mean, it's an error in our thinking that the self is a very concrete thing. And so if you say that I'm this, well, that's what I am. If I'm a big girl's blouse and I'm soft, that's how I'll be. And so that's what people think, you know. And so it's really important that when you externalize something, you know, you remove the problem. So narrative therapy would say the problem is the problem. The child isn't the problem. The problem is the problem. And with the way you're talking to your students, is that's what you did there. As you said, you know, this is the issue here. We need to look at this, not you, but this behavior. Right. And it's not me. Holy, it just changes their thinking. And then you reframe it for them.
Yeah. So you're such a renaissance man. I'm curious what your career is going to hold for you in the future.
Well, I'm thinking about forming the Beatles next now, and I see, is that a Rickenbacker in the background there, Kirk?
No, it's yeah, I won't go into it, but yeah. it's not a Rickenbacker.
It looks lovely anyway. I play the guitar myself. Okay. I love music. But so the future, I set up a charity. I work in the Philippines a lot. I've been working there for 15 years. I've got a charity called Embrace Philippines. I'm hoping to develop that further. It's all about inclusion. I work with the Badjo children out there. It's a wonderful, it's just an incredible experience.
And which children?
The Badjo, they're an incredible tribe. They're a seafaring tribe, Kirk. If you ever felt you wanted to come out and experience this thing, I'd love to have you over there. It's an incredible experience. I've been working there now for 15 years. 2 years ago, I set up a cultural exchange where they came to Ireland. Three members of the tribe came to Ireland and lived with me and my family. It was just an incredible experience. And they're called Badjo. They're seafaring. So they live above the water, you know, really rudimentary, really, you know, their only financing is the fathers kind of swim for pearls. The fathers can hold their breaths for up to 5 minutes, and they walk on the seabed and they go, you know, fishing, and they collect pearls, and then the kids sell the pearls. It's just an incredible culture. They're the most beautiful, open and funny people you'll ever meet. And I've been doing that now for 15 years. And at the moment we're trying to build a school, but it's been slow because of COVID, and they've been very heavily affected by it. So, you know, I'm trying to set up a medical mission where we're providing food and medicine and education. And we're training Badjos to go into third level education so that they can come back and educate their own and set up a system where it just sustains itself, you know, and that's what we're trying to do at the moment. And it's just,
where can people find out more information about that?
Yeah, you can go onto our webpage called embracephilippines.ie, www.embracephilippines.ie. We have a webpage there, and you can contact us, and we have a newsletter that goes out. We talk about what we're doing, and it's just a real passion of mine. It's just something that I feel incredibly privileged and honored to be able, to be allowed into this tribe. And I always leave a little bit guilty, thinking I learned a lot more again about myself than they could have ever got from us and our project. You know, they're just, it's hard to describe them, but they're the most open and honest people. There's no guard. You know, in Western society, we have a bit of a guard, checking each other out to see what you're about and do I like you, and, you know, all this kind of stuff that we have, and we're closed. They're just the most open and actually hilarious people you'll ever meet. And, you know, I go over there once a year and I bring over students and we do a project, and it's great fun. You know, it is great fun, but it's just, that's something that I want to work in more as I get older in my life, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know if this applies, but I will sometimes talk about the idea that as our societies, our Western societies, become the way that they are, which is more isolated, more technology oriented, more work oriented, more, I don't know, keeping up with the Joneses, disconnected. Yeah. And along the way, we think of ourselves as entitled or privileged, and we will look at a tribe that is, you know, struggling and having to work all day long and trying to find fish and oysters and pearls and whatnot. And they can't afford an iPhone or maybe even a roof over their head. And we look at them when we think, oh, poor them. It must be really terrible to be them. But then you meet them and they're
rich,
1,000 times happier than the average American is. And the, you know, lesson potentially is that our bias for materialism, for technology, for the kinds of things that we will value is actually in direct opposite with our human needs. You know,
when
you live in a situation like maybe the people you're talking about, you're in frequent contact with your friends and family, you are connecting with nature, you're not being bombarded with a bunch of complicated emails and tasks, and you are able to speak your mind directly to someone. You don't have to tweet, you know, all that facilitates attachment and our natural state and happiness and feeling of safety. Do you experience that with those people?
I couldn't agree more with what you're saying there and echo it. And I've written a lot about this in Ireland. I think it really is a striking observation as a human being. you know, to go out there and to see a people, and you have preconceived presuppositions about wealth and attaining things and gaining stuff. And I think it's such a good point you raise, because I talk a lot about what, you know, happiness and how to achieve happiness and contentment, you know, whatever that is. And a huge thing I find when I'm with the Bajo is that they are so connected to each other. Mm. In one small little tiny room with a corrugated sheet of iron over them, you might have the grandmother, the parents, the children, and their children. So you'd have like four or five lines of the family. And then they're all connected. You know, their neighbors next door, their uncles, and their the whole community are connected to each other. There's no doors that lock them off from each other. They're all open. It's like some sort of Sophoclean play. They can all come in and out of each other's house. It's an incredible existence. And when they came to Ireland to live with me for 3 months, I asked them many times, what do you think of my life? They'd say, too fast. Mm. Too fast. And they say, when do you get time to, you know, be you? And they couldn't get over the concept of child minding was something that just blew their mind. Child minding.
Oh, you know, minding.
That a stranger, you'd give your child to a stranger and you'd remunerate that stranger with money for minding your child. They couldn't get this concept. I mean, they really struggled. It was actually a very funny picture I took when they first came. They saw the dishwasher and they're like, what the hell is that? And I was like, that's a dishwasher that washes the dishes. And they were like, what? And what's this? And I was like, that's a washing machine. They're like, what the hell is that about? And I was like, well, that's what we do here. And they're like, well, why can't you do it yourself? You know? And they have no word for suicide in their culture. Mm. You know, and they struggle. I mean, you know, they struggle to get food. Their struggle is food and that. But they are, if you were looking at a happiness monitor, you know, they are way up there. And I think it's because they're connected. And I think that's what we suffer with. I think it's a fool's errand bringing things into your life and searching for materialism and trying to gain. Because ultimately, you know, when you do gain, you realize it doesn't sustain at all. Buying a nice car, it's a nice little moment for like, you know, a day or two, but after that it's gone, you know, and that's, it's so ephemeral. Materialism is such an ephemeral, short lasting thing. Mm. So what sustains us is connecting. I think as a society, I think COVID probably has probably illuminated it. Social distancing, it's not something we're good at. Right. We need to be more connected. And yeah. I, you know, even here in Antioch, when I, you know, you go into the toilet, everything is like, you know, just, you put your hand under, you don't touch anything, you get the thing, it comes. So we're disconnecting ourselves massively from each other. And I think it's something that's probably seen the rise in, you know, why we feel so unhappy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well put. And the other aspect of this, other than materialism, is living arrangements and what we value, you know, as people get more money, they get bigger and bigger homes. Mm. And everyone gets their own room. Everyone gets their own office.
More detached.
Right. Everyone gets their own spot in the garage, and the house is further away from your neighbors. Like, that's the ideal. Mm. The ideal is bigger house, bigger yard, more rooms. And I think that that's not necessarily a terrible thing, but I think that people need to think about, you know, because it gets annoying, you know, people get on your nerves, right? But I don't know if it's an American thing or a Western thing or a human thing, but when we get annoyed with people, because I'm guessing that the group of people you're talking about, they occasionally get annoyed with people, right? They get annoyed with each other. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it happens at least sometimes. And there's an impulse of like, well, I need to isolate myself away from them to avoid getting annoyed. But the hidden cost there obviously is all the benefits you were talking about. Yeah, for sure. Interesting. Well, is that what you're going to be spending all your time on? Because I'm under the impression you're doing like 15 different things.
No, I do a lot of things. I must say, I do a lot of things. I love the diversity of work. I would find doing one thing quite, you know, I'd get bored with it quite quickly. So I like doing, my week is very diverse, you know.
So what else are you going to be doing in the future?
I've got a book in the pipeline. I'm, you know, just at the moment writing a new book about basically the impact the family has on you through your development. And it's kind of like what I'm trying to write is a book that will help people who have been labeled parents, you know, in their relationships, parenting their kids, but also kids who've come through families that have been labeled and trying to rewrite or reauthor those ideas. So it's a book kind of that's designed to help kind of like everybody. So I'm going to start that. I've got the go ahead on it. So I'm going to start that now in the fall. So that's the big next thing. Series 2 of Eating with the Enemy is coming out. So that's going to be something I've been working with in the winter in Ireland. And I write every Thursday. So I'm going to keep that going. I love my column. I love working for the Irish Examiner. It's just a great space that they say to me, write whatever you want to write about. That's incredible.
What's your next article about?
It might be this. It could be this. It could be this conversation. I'll have to sit. I'll have to let this kind of like percolate for a while and see how I feel about what kind of came up here. It could be this. I definitely have one about Seattle. I did write about my first interaction with Seattle last 2 weeks ago about inclusion and coming to Antioch in my Fulbright. I do find the homeless and the drug epidemic here in Seattle quite striking coming from Ireland.
Yeah, tell us about that, because I only observe it as a layperson. Yeah. I read articles, but I feel lost.
I work with, at times I get invited into the Irish government to talk to the Prime Minister, the Taoiseach as we call him, about mental health issues. And I was thinking, if I was asked in here to talk about Seattle, I'd have so many things to say as an outsider's perspective.
Yeah.
I think people need to hear it, because you have a beautiful city here. I mean, Washington, my God, it's an incredible, it's just so beautiful. And Seattle is a city, my God, it's incredible. I'm blown away by it, because I've never come up this area. I always go to kind of like, you know, New York, Boston. I lived in Providence for a while, you know, so I've always gone around there, but I've never come up here. I've gone to Florida, but I've never come up here. And this is my first time up here. And I was into Nirvana and the whole grunge thing in the 90s. And I saw loads of interviews and I thought that city looks pretty cool. We watched Frasier. I saw Sleepless in Seattle. So I was very aware of the city, but never had never experienced it firsthand. And I suppose what struck me is the beauty and then the homeless crisis and the heroin, as I would see it. Maybe I'm wrong, but from my point of view, a heroin epidemic, you know, the needles everywhere. Because I got my daughters here with me. My family are here with me in America. And we walk down to, you know, Pike Market most evenings. And it's quite striking.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to help my kids process what they're seeing, you know.
So I'm curious, what else do you observe about us in America and or Seattle?
It's like the smell in someone's house. They don't know it because they live in it for so long. You walk and go, what the hell is this? I suppose I haven't really got a good view of, that's not a good view, but I haven't got a correct view because of the pandemic. There's no one in here. I'm in here myself doing my research and I'm connecting online to classes. So I don't get a real sense of the milieu or the cultural, the community part of it.
Yeah.
I suppose that's what I don't get to see. And it's a pity because, you know, you don't often get Fulbright scholarships. And unfortunately, I got it when I was in the midst of the bloody pandemic. So I'm not getting a good swing at it. But, it's a very good question. I suppose what I've noticed here, that you're probably aware of it, though, you're much more vocal about Black Lives Matter than we are in Ireland. Mm. We don't really talk about it so much. Mm. You know, there was just a rally there a couple of days ago when I was getting my daughter's haircut, and they came past, and it was a rally about Black Lives Matter, and you know, and I suppose I find that as a city, it's very vocal, and I see things on the window that says, you know, we believe in Black Lives Matter. If you don't come in. Mm-hmm. Now, you'd never see that in Ireland. I've never seen that before. Mm. You know, that's the first time I've ever seen a sign like that. I suppose it just the systemic racism part. I suppose maybe you're more in tune with it than we are. You know, as a society, we're quite small. We're diverse, but not for long. You know, we're only diverse for the last 30 years, probably. You know, when I grew up in school, there wouldn't have ever been a black child in there with me. I've never met a black teacher in my experience going through education. Mm. And we don't hear about systemic racism, but there it is right there. You know, the fact that you don't see people in the, you know, black community working in education. Mm. That's a piece there that we don't address or talk about. So we're less vocal about it. I suppose something that I think, maybe this is something that I think, right? And it might be a bit controversial, but this is what I think. I think you think you're liberal in America, you know, and I think we probably think we're not liberal in Ireland, and we probably are quite liberal. We're quite, do you understand what I mean?
Yeah,
what I mean
absolutely.
By that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That there's, I think for all the land of the free, I think America can be quite puritanical, and a lot of stuff doesn't get talked about, and it's just kind of swept under the carpet a little bit. Whereas in Ireland, we think we're more conservative than we are. If you understand what I mean.
Yeah, I don't know about Ireland, but I do sometimes think about how liberal Americans will think of themselves as very liberal, meaning that they're very open-minded, they're very accepting, they're not oppressing other people, and yet they absolutely are, you know.
Unknown to themselves, I suppose, and that's probably the most dangerous position to find yourself in.
Right. So off topic, what's the most annoying thing about Seattle or Americans to you?
You're going to get me in trouble here. What's the most annoying thing about Americans? I think probably over-validating every feeling.
Oh, what do you mean? For other people or themselves?
For themselves. Or I suppose what I find about Americans is they talk about, you know, recent events with like 4 seconds ago, as if it was something that happened a long time ago. You know, and then I was like, and then that was like, we're like in the middle of the conversation. It's hard to explain what I mean, but I suppose the over-validating of feelings. I come from Ireland. We're Catholics, you know, we're very emotionally repressed. So, you know, we don't express too much emotions, you know, a lot, you know. And so I find it, you know, when, and I can hear walking on the street conversation, I felt this when you said that. And they're in the middle of the conversation that she felt this about in the middle, you know. And, you know, it's in that moment I'm kind of going, my God, you'd never hear a conversation like that in Ireland. And it's probably, that's probably a little thing that kind of just a cultural irks me a little bit, the over-validation of every feeling.
Like if it taken to an extreme, it's too navel-gazy, too narcissistic.
Maybe. Or that all feelings have to be validated. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Or that you have to think, am I okay now? How am I feeling now? I mean,
right.
You know, so just, you know, we'd be very much the strong silent types in Ireland. You just suck it up and you get on, you keep going.
Right.
Not that healthy either, but we've made a correction in that one. But I suppose that's something that irks me a little bit.
I'm curious, how often do you hear people saying that? Is it frequently?
It would be, actually, you know, every time I get the ferry to go over to Bainbridge or in the streets and sitting in a cafe there, I'd hear people talking about their, you know, just, it's funny, I suppose.
That's really interesting. I mean, I'm going to have to take note of that. Because you know, I trust your observation. And it's, as you say, you walk into a house where there's a funny smell, the residents never smell it because they're nose blind, and someone from the outside notices things. And so I'll have to take note of that.
I was listening to a conversation on the, but this is probably an example of it. I don't know what it is I'm trying to explain, but it's definitely something I feel when I'm in America. And this girl was talking to her boyfriend and she asked him, what's your true north? Right. And I was like, what? Listen to this, you know, just listening into it. And he was like, well, and they were having this conversation about what's his kind of truth, I think, you know. And you know, you would never hear a conversation like that in Europe. You know, somebody never said to you, what's your true north, Richard? Like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
What are you on about?
I suppose that's kind of a West Coast thing, honestly, because it reminds me of...
It's kind of lovely in a way. I think it's kind of lovely, but it's kind of just, I suppose it's just striking for me.
It's sort of stoner talk. I feel like the West Coast has a fair amount of stonerism in its culture of just like, whoa, dude, like, what are you feeling, man?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. What's coming up for you now?
Yeah, there's a lot of that that's been going on since the 70s, I think. And so I think Seattle probably has a fair amount of that. That's funny.
Then as Europeans, I suppose, what we notice when we look at America is that a lot of Americans, not all Americans, but a lot of Americans talk about it being the greatest country in the world. And it's a great country. But as you know, it is a great country. As I said, in Ireland, it's like a concept. It's hard to explain it. It's like a dream almost. This idea of America. It's such a beautiful dream kind of to us. But there's, you know, if you need to say that it's the greatest country in the world, and I hear this when I watch Fox News, you know, they talk about this is the greatest country in the world. I'm like, well, you'd never hear an Irish person or an Irish prime minister or, you know, the Taoiseach say, this is the greatest country in the world. You'd never hear the French president saying, this is the greatest country in the world. But it's just something that, American politicians often say. You're kind of going, who are they saying this to? Because who are they trying to convince? This is what I wonder. Who are they trying to convince when they say those things?
Yeah. And by what measure exactly? Yeah, right. Exactly. Like, what's your metric?
What's the metric here? Or, you know?
I think that has to do with the fact that in other parts of the world, you have the benefit of having other countries that are close by. In the United States,
I think you're right.
Vast majority of Americans, the only borders they would and if ever they would cross would be into Canada or Mexico. Mm. And so, and I think the vast majority of Americans don't even do that. So there's this ignorance of, you know, I'll never forget. There was a sort of a distant relative, and that we were, it was during the Fukushima earthquake.
Oh, yeah.
And the, you know, it was in the news and we were talking about it over dinner, and this distant relative said something like, oh yeah, I mean, earthquake in Japan, you know, and those other countries, their buildings are just so flimsy. They just like fall down. And I'm like,
what the hell?
I'm like, Japan is one of the most technologically advanced and particularly with earthquake safety.
Their buildings move with it.
Yeah. In the world. And she just had this idea of like, well, it's another country, therefore it must just be, you know, one of those crap countries, you know, as some politicians would call it. And I'm like, the ignorance of that statement, you know, like, and the notion that another country could actually have something better than the United States is actually exactly. really quite strange to people. Like, wait, some another country's doing something better than us? That can't be, you know, we have the biggest military, we have, you know, Hollywood and Apple, and, you know, we're the best, and it limits us severely, you know, and I think Europe benefits from being able to say, huh, well, you know, Ireland's doing this thing and they seem to be doing well. Let's try to adopt.
Exactly. We do that with Europe. We do look at each other and there's a lot of communication between the countries, a lot of conferences, a lot of meetings about what's going on, what's working. I think you're right about America. I think it's such a vast continent. I can see why people don't leave it. You know, you can see why people holiday down to San Francisco or go to Vegas or go to Miami. You can see it's got as a country, it's got everything in this. I mean, it's just incredible. I absolutely love this country, and I feel connected to it, and I can't wait to go down to Mississippi at some point and do that, you know, and go to, you know, I really want to drive through there when my kids get a bit older and go to, you know, Kentucky and see where Ali grew up. And, you know, my whole childhood has been, you know, these kind of ideas and Elvis, and so I'm really into bluegrass music, and I just can't wait to get down there and be a part of all that. But a little funny anecdote, I was in New York in 2015, and we were in a bar, and these girls came over chatting to us, and we were chatting to them, and they were saying, where are you guys from? And we were like, we're from Ireland. And they're like, oh my God, that's amazing. And they're like, do you guys know of Michael Jackson? And I just played along, and I was like, Michael who? Like, Michael Jackson? I was like, no, never heard of him. I was like, what is he, a basketball player? She's like, no, Michael Jackson. And then she's like, oh my God, they don't know who Michael Jackson is. She's like, do you know Coca-Cola? And I was like, no, Coca-Cola. And we had this conversation. It was just funny. Myself and my brother were laughing. And I asked her, I said, what do you do as a career? Do you mind me asking? She said, I'm a primary school teacher. And I said, when the kids ask you about Europe, what do you tell them? And she's like, what do you mean? I said, because you've obviously got a concept of Ireland has been like, you know, we're all in caves and there's no TV. I was like, of course, and rolling hills and there's no community. I was like, of course we know Michael Jackson. Of course. I said, he played in Ireland in like 1986, for God's sake, in Cork. I said, of course we know him. Of course we know Coke. I was like, I think you need to have a little look outside America and see what's going on in the other parts of the world, because, you know, your kids are going to ask you about it.
Right.
You have to be able to inform them about it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's been a great honor, Kirk. I mean, honestly, I've known of you now for about 5 or 6 years, and I do listen to your podcast, and I do feel somehow that you're responsible for this chaos in my life currently in Antioch University. That you put me in the right direction. So, I mean, when I sent you that email the first time, because I saw a video of you talking about Antioch, I thought, that's the dude I want to talk to there. He seems to know his stuff. And when we spoke, you know, you could have easily kind of gone, whatever, and ignored that email, but you were generous enough of spirit to say, you know who you need to talk to? It's Colin Ward. And so you pointed me in the right direction. So for that, I am eternally grateful. So thank you so much. And can I just say to your listeners, if they want to connect with me, they can. I'm on Instagram, official Richard Hogan. And I'm always putting up my articles that I write for the paper, and I'm putting up ideas about parenting, and I'm putting up ideas about society and how we can be more inclusive as a society. I'd love to connect with some of your listeners if they wanted to. That's official Richard Hogan on Instagram.
Yeah, great.
All right.
Well, everyone out there, please take care of yourself. Because why, Richard?
Because you are absolutely unique, and there is no one but you in this world, and our time here is finite, and make the most of it and free yourself from all the negative stuff that holds you back and just thrive.